And Sam is here. So what was this job? I mean, Jersey, that's a pretty nice place to live and work, isn't it?
Hi, Johnny. Yeah, absolutely wonderful place to work. Beautiful islands, nice mellow lifestyle, but the work can be rather manic. And I guess I'm a little bit tickled by the earlier part of your show, all the talks about no lunch breaks and no tea breaks and too many hours, because in a way that was what actually started me off with the whole thought, do something different.
So it was all, you're earning reasonable money, but you weren't getting time to actually enjoy the benefit of it because you were working so many hours.
I was working ridiculous hours, and I was promoting chasing as most of us do. And I think, again, as many of us do, I started to think, well, actually, am I heading in the right direction with my life? Am I doing the right things? And when I sat down and thought about it more, I started to think, well, actually, no, I'm not really enjoying this anymore. There must be something else that I can do. And then I started to think a little bit outside of the box, and the idea began to grow.
I mean, were you inspired by any other people who've done similar journeys?
I didn't know any bikers at all, not one single biker, when I started the idea of this. I had read Ted Simon's Jupiter's Travels. He's a chap that I think many parents want to lock up because their sons and daughters go off and do mad things as a result of his books.
And did it, you know, it takes a certain amount of bravery, doesn't it, to give up a safe job, a regular income, and just go into the unknown and go travelling?
One of my bosses said to me, I think you're stark staring bonkers because you're at a stage of your career where if you take a step back now, you're going to really badly damage it. And then after a few moments thought, he looked at me, cocking his head to one side and said, I wouldn't mind coming with you, though.
You see, everybody dreams of it. Few people actually do it. And you couldn't even ride a motorbike when this idea was born, is that right?
No, that's absolutely right. This is really thinking outside of the box. I'd always kind of liked the idea of learning to ride a motorcycle, and the two things started to slot in together quite nicely. I think if I'd known more about riding a motorcycle and what I was facing, perhaps I might have been too afraid to do it. So in some circumstances, ignorance is bliss.
So how much experience have you had of biking before you set off?
I'd been riding a bike for 3 months by the time I hit the edge of the Sahara.
There's a great photo in the book of how you packed the bike.
Isn't
with the
that,
caption, how not to pack a bike. I mean, you got everything on there but the kitchen sink.
I worked on the plan that, because I didn't know really what I was doing, I'd deal with every eventuality by the right bit of kit. And the salesman, of course, saw me coming. And I had something for every eventuality. And the bike was just ridiculously overloaded. And, of course, with no experience and nobody to really talk to about it, it was really badly loaded too.
What sort of bike did you get?
I had a 1991 R80 GS. Somebody told me that this was a perfect bike. It was idiot-proof.
And did it turn out to be that way?
It's been absolutely fantastic. The bike's got 240,000 miles on it now, and it's hardly ever gone wrong. When she has gone wrong, she's always done it within a few miles of somebody who knows about BMWs. Now, there's class.
Mm. So you set off from Jersey. From Jersey, yeah?
Indeed.
To where?
I hopped over to the mainland first. I had some visas to pick up in London, and then down across Europe, France, Italy, into Greece, and then the last moments of knee-knocking, butterflies, before getting onto the boat and heading across to Egypt.
Mm. And how were you getting on the early days? I often wonder, you know, do you think everything's going great and, yeah, this is going to be peachy, no problems here?
I think I was scared a lot of the time. Once I'd made the commitment to do the thing, I really started to think even more hard about what I was actually setting out to do. And how much I didn't know really started to dawn on me.
And did you wish that you'd actually done a bit more research and trying to talk to somebody who'd done it? Because you backpacked before, though, hadn't you? So you'd got a bit of experience of travelling.
Yeah, that's right. I think the backpacking actually made quite a difference to me because I learned the value of respecting other people and not being afraid of people at first glance. And it's an automatic reaction for us to be nervous of people that we don't know in situations that we don't understand. And that first backpacking trip really taught me to take people as individuals. And if you treat them with respect, then inevitably you get respect back. It's very seldom that you don't.
Mm. And what about the roads? When did they start getting bad? When did the tarmac run out?
The tarmac ran out at the bottom of Egypt. I couldn't take the land crossing between Egypt and Sudan. The border was closed, loads of barbed wire and anti-tank obstacles and old oil drums with skull and crossbones and all of that sort of thing made it perfectly obvious. So I went on the ferry across Lake Nasser. down to Wadi Halfa, which is right in the middle of the desert. It's stinking hot, and yeah, the sand starts there. In fact, one of the chaps I talked to on the way down said to me, oh yes, real Africa starts at Wadi Halfa.
Yeah. And then came the Sahara Desert. And there was some advice about riding across there, was there not?
I'd read quite a few books before I left about how to deal with desert riding and desert conditions and what to do if you broke down and things like that. But they never really bring it home to you until you're actually there and trying it for the first time. And my bike, for example, it was so overloaded. It was like riding an upside-down pendulum the first time I hit the soft sand. It was a very, very scary thing to do. In fact, it's still one of the scariest things I ever have done.
And what about the people? How did they react to you?
Mostly curiosity. In one or two places, in Ethiopia, for example, I rode into one village with some friends who I'd met along the way, and quite a lot of the people ran away and hid. The war had only recently finished, just by a couple of weeks, and they didn't know what to make of us. Most of the people had never seen tourists on motorcycles before, so it wasn't surprising that they ran away and hid. In fact, it was a child who was the first one who popped his head around the side of a mud hut that started to break the ice.
And what about your bike at night? I mean, Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman, you know, they did their lovely round-the-world trip on 1,200 GSs, and they were carrying quite a lot of stuff. And, you know, they were staying in cheap places and having to hoik all his gear up the stairs to their hotel room. And how did you make sure your bike was safe, and what did you do with all your gear?
In Africa, a lot of the places that I stayed were cheap local hotels. When you're travelling on a budget, then you want to do that anyway. But also, if you want to get beneath the surface of a country and actually learn something about it, then when you're rubbing shoulders with people who eat, sleep and breathe the place, then, you know, you've got much more chance of contact. Most of the local hotels were ground level only. There was one hotel that I stayed in that had a flight of steps that I had to get the bike up. The owner of the hotel very kindly said I could park the bike in his restaurant overnight, and I'd never ridden up steps before. And I managed to fall off three times very enthusiastically, much to the sheer joy of the people who joined to watch, before I actually finally managed to make it up the steps.
Sam Manikon is here on Radio 2, talking about his adventures that he's detailed in his book called Into Africa. So how many times did you fall off?
Oh, I lost count. Part of the trip was, the trip was done in part for charity. I did the trip for Children in Need and Mission Aviation Fellowship. And the children in the schools on the island of Jersey sponsored me for the number of countries that I was going to ride across, which they thought was highly appropriate, as when I started approaching them, I didn't know how to ride a bike. One child said to me, so how many times are you going to fall off? I bet you fall off loads in every single country. Yeah, well, he was right. I did lose count.
Mm. And could you always get it up again, or you on your own, or do you have help? Or
a lot of the time I needed to have help. My bike was so overloaded. I actually slipped a disc, or started slipping one, trying to pick up my bike, before I learned enough to say, well, actually, you've got to get rid of some of this stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, most people, you know, they start out with a load of stuff, realise they're carrying far too much, and then get rid of, you know.
The biggest difficulty for me was that I didn't know what to dump. I did things like cut my bar of soap in half and get rid of extra pairs of socks and that sort of thing. But the most weight came from all of the spare parts. And because I was a mechanical klutz, I had to keep those spare parts. I didn't have a clue which were the logical ones to get rid of. In fact, further down in Africa, the reputation got around. If you have need a spare part for a BMW, find Sam Manicom. He's going to have it.
And did you have enough money to fund the whole trip, or did you stop and do jobs along the way?
For this particular year of the trip, no, I didn't do any jobs. I had enough money. I'd very carefully budgeted, and I was very pleasantly surprised at how little it cost me to do.
Yeah. And what was the worst instance? Didn't you get thrown in jail?
I did. Coming down through Tanzania, the last town in Tanzania, town called Mbeya, I had a friend, an American friend, on the back of the bike. I'd met him. He was backpacking, and he had a couple of weeks before he was due to go back to the States. And he joined me, and we were rolling into this last town. And when a bus stops in Africa, you slow right down, because all of a sudden it's bedlam. People leaping off the bus, people rushing towards the bus, trying to sell people on the bus things, luggage coming off, and all sorts of things. So you slow right down, and, of course, by that time I knew the rules. You do slow down. And I guess I was going about 20 kilometres an hour, no more than that, headlight on, thumb on the horn. And things pretty much calmed down by the time I got to the bus, but a chap stepped out in front of me and I hit him very hard.
And so the police obviously turned up, did they?
Yes, they did. To begin with, I thought I was going to be lynched. I'd heard all of the stories about other motorcyclists who had hit people. I know of some that were killed by the local people when they'd been caught in that sort of circumstance, and other people who'd been beaten up, and I thought that was going to happen to me. My friend John had badly damaged his knees, and so I wasn't going to be able to do a runner, and that was what everybody said you had to do, although it went totally against the instinct if you've hurt somebody. But the police turned up and they were extremely suspicious about how far the bike had slid. They just weren't used to a big bike, smooth road, smooth luggage and all of that sort of thing. And, they nabbed me and stuck me in prison.
And what was that like, first night in jail?
The most scariest experience of my life to date. It was like being thrown onto a set of a B-movie. Little window high on the wall, shaft of light coming down through the darkness. The place stunk of feces and urine, and it was really humid and dank in there. And as my eyes got used to the darkness, I realised there were a lot of other blokes in there. I think there were 20-odd in there. And, one of them, he decided that he was going to approach me with certain activities in mind that I wasn't that keen on.
Mm. What you call guards to help you out, or
you know, sometimes when you're in your life, you act instinctively. Just something makes you do or behave in a particular way, and you don't even think about it. And that was one of those situations. I was scared silly. I was in deep trouble, and I just started thrashing out and yelling guard at the top of my voice. And I was really lucky because there was obviously a guard fairly close by, and he came running in and caught this man about to do what he was about to do and dragged me out. And he stuck me in a room on my own, and I sat feeling really sick. Just my whole body was shaking from that.
And how long were you in jail?
Well, fortunately, only a few hours. I was very, very lucky. You know how you hear an awful lot of bad press about the British embassies and the various countries and how little they do for tourists and travellers and so on? Well, I was very lucky because a representative of the British embassy had actually driven past the scene of the accident shortly after, and he turned up at the prison. I was also very lucky because a retired Tanzanian army captain, Captain Joseph, had seen the accident, and he'd come along and was translating for me. My Swahili was good enough to deal with bargaining in the market, but certainly not to deal with this sort of experience. And between the two of them, they got me released into the custody of the representative of the embassy.
You explained it wasn't really your fault. This guy just stepped out right in front of you.
Of course, absolutely. But the police, they just didn't seem to understand how I could possibly not have been speeding and driving carelessly. Initially, I was told I was going to be charged with speeding and driving without due care and attention. They tagged another charge on the end, and that was attempt to commit grievous bodily harm. Yeah. They said I'd ridden at him on purpose.
So how did that change the way that you then continued your journey?
I think it didn't really change it that much. In that I'd always had the respect for the people, and I'd always been riding with caution and awareness of the surroundings that I was in. There's a quote that goes words to the effect that there are no tourists in a strange land. The tourists are the strange land, if you're with me. I've probably totally misquoted that, by the way. But I think you get the gist. And because of that, you do really concentrate hard on the fact that you are the stranger, and your senses have to be alive to every little circumstance that you find yourself in. So I was already working that way. But it made me really conscious of the value of life.
Mm. There is a lovely quote at the start of one of your chapters that I made a note of. It said, "A tourist sees what he wants to see. A traveller sees what he sees."
Yes, that's a lovely one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've been a tourist plenty of times. I like my 2-week holiday and the sunshine, but I tend to go with a two-week holiday and the sunshine in mind, and I go there specifically to see and do particular things. But the thing that I love about touring on a long-distance trip is the fact that you take every day as it comes, and you have maybe your list of top 100 things that you want to see and be involved in, but you take every day as it comes, and if you allow yourself enough time, then you've got the opportunity to explore the eventualities as they pop up.
And there's something special about doing it on a motorbike rather than in a car, isn't there?
It's absolutely fantastic. Now, I know you're a biker, so you know exactly what I mean when I say all of your senses zing when you're on a motorcycle. You're out there, you're in it. Your sense of smell works, your sense of touch works. You feel the temperature changes, all of those sort of things, and that's a fantastic way to tour a continent like Africa. But it also works very well because those who do the trip in a four-wheel drive, for example, they're inside a metal and glass box, and that's creating a barrier between you and the people. And the people make a trip like this.
Yeah. People are what it's all about, isn't it?
Absolutely right.
A couple of texts coming in. Your guest has done the right thing. I took 2 years off and sailed alone across the Atlantic. Life is too short. There's a big world out there. That's Ian in Cornwall. And Nick said he needs to read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Did you ever come across that book?
I read it 3 times. The first time I read it and didn't understand it. The second time I read it and didn't understand it. And the third time I realised that I actually wasn't supposed to understand all of it, that there were sections of key messages in there.
Definitely. And will you do it again?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Yeah.
It gets in the blood. Travelling gets in the blood, but travelling by motorcycle bites deep.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. Sam Manicom, the book is called Into Africa. It's published by Trafford. It's out now at £13.50. And I will play the song for you and also your friend Dave at CW Motorcycles.
Great.